Yeah, sure, sure.
What is the, what was the moral and Catholic thing to do in that case?
Well,
what would you consider?
Yeah, well, not being a doctor myself and not having been there and not knowing all the details, it's a lot of qualifications, but it seems that in her situation, her body was still accepting the artificial nutrition and hydration, meaning that it had not become futile. It was still helpful. It was still beneficial. But all sorts of other arguments were used of, well, she might just stay this way forever. Well, number one, she's not going to stay this way forever. I mean, everyone's going to die eventually. But people said stuff like, well, you heard stuff like dignity, like, oh, she has no more dignity. Well, again, she has the exact same dignity as everyone, you know, so her dignity did not go anywhere. It appears as though her body was still accepting it, and it appears, especially afterwards, you see all these other things that happened with the other guy within Scott, or the husband who had something, fling going on with someone else, and they wanted to get married, and so it was very iffy. Again, talk about the circumstances. The circumstances were very iffy because it made you wonder, like, what's this guy's real intention? Is his intention really to, you know? And I'm just asking questions. I'm not judging. I'm just asking these kinds of questions. So it is kind of a big can of worms. But it seems as though in her particular situation, it had not become futile. It seems that it was still beneficial. And that actually raises another point, just real quick, is one of the points that is sometimes written into some of these living wills, again, this is why a Catholic one is very helpful, is it talks about recovery. Well, what do we mean by recovery? Do we mean back to how you were before this particular incident, accident, illness, whatever? Or do we mean you're not back to how you were beforehand, but you're still better than dead. You know, I mean, you're still, you know, at some varying degree in there. And so sometimes the problem becomes when the documents talk about, well, when there's no hope of recovery, well, what do we mean by that? You know, when there's no hope of getting me back to how I was, or when there's no hope of me ever being able to feed myself, is that recovery? When there's no hope of me being able to walk, is that recovery? When there's no hope of me being able to think, is that recovery? I mean, from a Catholic perspective, we say dignity is not, you know, dignity is not changed in any of these situations. But what were you going
to? You know, I'm just trying to put it all into a personal perspective. You know, from her own perspective, for me,
yeah.
I wouldn't want to continue mm-hmm. in her state. Maybe mm-hmm. initially for a while, try, okay, but then after a while, no. Am I morally wrong in the Catholic sense?
Well, again, but I would just look at what you're saying. I mean, I don't want. I mean, again, it's not up to you. Again, life is a you're steward. You're not the donor. So at a certain point, this whole even talk of, well, I wouldn't want to be that way. Well, sorry, it's not up to you.
That she wanted.
That she had apparently told him.
Right.
She would never
want
to be that way.
Written documentation
yeah.
or anything.
But you're saying that even if there was written documentation, it would be morally correct.
Well,
that's what I'm trying to get.
But again, I'm trying to tread carefully here because I don't know what exactly the circumstance, all the circumstances. I don't know had it become. Because again, you Catholics have no obligation. If you take away nothing else from tonight, take away this, these two points. The first is that you have no obligation to either ask for or accept that which is futile, those interventions which are futile, right? So that's point one. You have no obligation either to ask for, because some people think, well, do I have to ask for this? You know, well, no. And you have no obligation to ask for or accept those medical interventions which are futile. And then even those medical interventions which are beneficial, you have no obligation to ask for or accept once they become burdensome.
Exclusions by the doctor?
No. That conclusion, that's the big issue, is burdensome to whom? You know, burdensome, it can't be burdensome to the doctor in the sense of like, you know, I could really use this bed for someone else, so let's get her out of here. It burdensome in terms of, you know, and this document talks a little bit about those different situations in which it can be burdensome. Burdensome in terms of its effect outweighs its harm. You know, so it's doing some good, but it's not doing more good to outweigh the pain that's coming from it. When it becomes extraordinary, when it becomes cost prohibitive, so that's why it's difficult to say. Like I said, that's why we don't talk about a procedure specific kind of thing. We talk about patient specific, like in this particular situation. And again, I wasn't there for Terry Schiavo. I don't know exactly how her body was responding to all of that, but. Well, and that says something too. The fact that, you know, her parents, again, said, you know, hey, she's our daughter, we love her, we are holding out some kind of hope that, and people have been known to come out of persistent vegetative states, despite the fact that it was diagnosed as persistent, people came out of it. So there's a sense always that kind of hope, and that says something too, that, you know, the fact that she was married, her husband actually had greater weight than her own parents, and so that's why her husband was able to make the call and not her parents. But that, yeah, I mean, that's a good point, Bob, because that said something too about all this. So, yeah. So,
having personally in the past decade having to make decisions twice, so with my mother and my grandmother, you know, you start obviously you start thinking about your situation. And the two things you just said, if you take nothing away, take two things away. Number one, you hear at least more and more of the situation where someone's diagnosed. Even a relatively younger person, able to make the decision for themselves, though, so say, for legal reasons, say adult. You're diagnosed with terminal illness and you're given 6 months. Would number one apply here? I mean, would you be, you know, are you somehow morally
obliged,
for lack of a better term, to at least try treatment? A lot of people, you hear more and more people are just saying, no, I don't. You know, it's the cost, the uncertainty of whether it's even going to work, period. Yeah, that's something that seems like it's a gray area. It's not really indivisible.
Right. And again, that's why when it comes to these issues, the church teaching is always patient-specific, not procedure-specific, is that we would look and we would say, okay, well, number one, how beneficial is it? Is it beneficial or is it futile? If it's able to extend your life by 6 months, is that beneficial? You know, maybe that would be beneficial because it would allow you to finally, you know, maybe a loved one is deployed in the military and they're not going to be back for another few months and you want to be able to say goodbye and spend some time and whatever. And so maybe for you, that would be beneficial, you know.
Or time for a miracle.
Or time for a miracle, yeah. But, and again, if it's diagnosed, the situation you're giving is that it's terminal.
It's terminal.
That there is, that even the most, the best doctors are saying, I can't do anything.
Recognizing that they're frequently wrong. But nevertheless, it was a little bit different than the end of life. And then when I talk to Dave,
right.
He's been given half a year, but
And that's one of the situations in which a Catholic would be, it would be okay for a Catholic to try the treatment, and it would also be okay for a Catholic to say, you know what, it would be futile, and therefore I don't have an obligation to ask for or accept that which is futile. But even if it is beneficial, at what point does it become burdensome? Because maybe we can give you this treatment that will keep you alive for 6 months longer, you're still going to die, but 6 months longer. But you're going to be in so much pain for those last 6 months of your life that you're really not going to have your wherewithal to say goodbye to all of those loved ones. You know, you have your wherewithal now, do it now, you know, that kind of thing. So.
You have to put another piece on the floor for that. You don't understand, so it's, I'll give somebody an opportunity to have a
saint. Yeah. To pray for someone's cause, for everything. Yeah. Well, because the law still is going to want something to go by. Because you can, again, this gets to the point of what you're willing to do, what the circumstances are. You know, nothing is wrong, for instance, with saying, I'm in a lot of pain, I want pain meds. Now, you don't have to accept pain meds. You could say, not to be sadistic, but you could say, I'm not going to have pain meds. I'm just going to offer it up. And I'm going to get all these souls out of purgatory by experiencing all this pain, so I don't need the pain meds. Perhaps it's virtuous, but you don't have to do that. That would be like heroic virtue, and you're not required to do that. It'd be great if you did. You'd be a saint faster. But yeah, I mean, you're again, part of it is because this is, and that's why I don't like that document that the state uses, is because it does kind of put it in these weird, you know, give me nothing, give me just ANH, give me everything. And that's why. Right. So you are a steward, but again, that being said, you can still, as a steward, you're able to make certain decisions. Being a steward doesn't mean you don't make any decisions. Being a steward means, you know, making prudential, informed decisions of, you know, well, it would be good to do this so that at least I have this time to receive the sacraments. Even though I might be in some more pain this way, I'm at least coherent to confess one last time, to receive the Eucharist one last time, and whatever. Or to say, you know, at this point it's become too cost prohibitive and yeah. Right. And that's no, but there is a certain role that stewards have, you know, in making some of those decisions. So that's why, you know, for instance, some of these hippies who say, you know, oh, well, you can't. I have a brother-in-law who's, I should probably stop recording. He's a good guy. He's from New England, and he's a Democrat, and he's just very, and he's Catholic, born and raised Catholic, but we always kind of get in these little tiffs here because he says, oh, you know, we're cutting down too many trees, or this or that, or the environment, and I say, look, yes, the environment is God's creation, and we should not be destroying it, and we should be preserving it. We should be doing everything we can as stewards. But part of being a steward is also knowing to use wisely. And so if I need to chop down this tree to build that house or to do this or to do that, well, that's being a good steward. Now, if I'm going to just chop down a whole bunch of trees just for the sake of chopping down trees, well, that's not being a good steward, you know. Or if I want to kill that animal so I can eat it, well, I'm allowed to do that, you know. I shouldn't just go killing animals for the sake of killing animals, but, you know, so that's part of the stewardship idea, is that you are still expected to use your reason and to apply it practically, you know. So that's why it's good to have something like, and what you'll notice when you read this Catholic Living Will is the Catholic Living Will doesn't have those options. The Catholic Living Will lays out, this is a very good summary of the Catholic teaching in this regard, because it says, my Catholic faith teaches this, therefore I want this, but keeping in mind that I don't need to blah, 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 and this and this and this, and it doesn't give check boxes. It lays out what you want, what you don't want, it explains certain circumstances, what to do, and then it gives you a signature block. You don't have check boxes. You get to appoint your healthcare agent, and then you sign it and have it notarized. And actually, that's something else it says here, too. They did the research. You actually don't have to have it notarized in the state of Maryland. It just needs to be witnessed. But it says if you're going to go across state lines, you should have it notarized. So, again, that's why this is so much better as a Catholic living will, because it kind of lays out the church teaching and says, do this, don't do that. Do this up to the point that, you know, if it becomes futile, or even if it is useful, once it becomes burdensome, then it can be, you know. So, other questions? Yes? Well, see, that's right, and that's the question was, is a feeding tomb considered extraordinary means? That's what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to avoid thinking of it in terms of procedures. We don't think of it as procedures. A feeding tube, most of the time, I mean, statistically speaking, most of the time, an IV or a peg tube, or whatever, that is ordinary means, but it can become extraordinary in a certain situation. And that's why we would not just say off the bat, an IV is always ordinary means and therefore it must always happen. Well, no, because an IV can become extraordinary. It can become futile, in which case it can and should be refused. If it's just going to make the person swell up and pump them full of fluids and their body's not absorbing it and the body's not processing it, well, yeah, it should be refused. So that's kind of the point I was trying to make here, is that the church would never say X is always ordinary, you know. Again, we look at the action itself, we look at the intentions, and we look at the circumstances, and you keep in mind doctrine of double effect, if any of those seem to confuse you. What is the intention here? Even if I foresee something, but it's unintended, if my intention is this, I can foresee this. And this actually explains the doctrine of double effect a little bit better. And then to determine, you know, what is useful, what is not useful, and then even that which is useful, when does it become burdensome? So. Yeah, I was going to say, Father Tom, apparently, this was before I got here, but I remember Father Ron was telling me when he had visited him at the hospital, most of the priests in the area all thought that he was, like, going to die, like on his way out, going to die. And here he is, you know. So, yeah, generally, and this is what caused some of the confusion with, like, Terry Schiavo, is there were a lot of these good rank-and-file Catholics who just kind of had that idea that, like, the food and water is always ordinary, must always be given, you know, and they're very well-intentioned, but that's not what the church teaches. The church teaches that even food and water can become extraordinary, can become disproportionate, and therefore refused. So, any other questions? Yes?
Yeah.
Her life was not chosen over the babies. That's a good question. That's why it's used with the doctrine of double effect, because it's not a matter of choosing her life over the babies. It's a matter of what am I doing? What is the actual action I am doing? When you remove a uterus, you're not killing, you're not directly killing someone, you're removing a uterus. Now, in this particular case, there was a baby growing inside of that uterus. That's much different than going into the uterus and killing the baby. So my intention in that situation is simply to stop the cancer, to save the woman's life. Now, I also would like to see the baby live too, of course. And that's why, if it is possible, and you can read all sorts of really inspiring stories of women who were in this situation, who had uterine cancer, and they knew that if they started doing the chemo or they started doing something else, that would probably kill the baby, and so they actually put up with the cancer until the baby was carried to term, or at least long enough to pull it out early, and they got the baby out, and then they were able to remove the uterus or do the chemo or whatever else. So you can, that of course would be the ideal. The ideal would be, you know, let's do that. But the whole point of the doctrine of double effect is that even when this other foreseen side effect is there. It is foreseen. It's not like the baby might die. No, the baby is going to die if you take out the uterus. There's no mites or ifs about it, you know. But that's not what I'm... The action I'm doing is not evil. I'm snipping out a uterus. The intention is not to kill the baby. The intention is simply to get rid of the cancer. And the circumstances are that... Well, the circumstances are that the woman's going to die otherwise. I mean, that's... Again, we're talking about a very specific situation.
Assuming she can't live.
Yeah, assuming the woman's not going to... you know, because then the other option is, you know, well... The woman's going to die, and the baby is probably going to die, too. So it's not a matter of choosing one life over the other. It's I'm trying to think of another good situation in which it another good doctrine of double effect situation. Well, like, for instance, here's another situation, ectopic pregnancies, right? So the zygote implants somewhere other than the uterus. Did you know, by the way, that ectopic pregnancies can occur not just in fallopian tubes, but on the ovary and actually outside of the ovary on the abdomen? Isn't that nasty that that can actually happen? I didn't realize that. We learned all of these things in the seminary. Because you think of ectopic pregnancies, you can think, okay, yeah, well, it implants in the fallopian tube. You understand how that happens. But to implant on the ovary or, like, on the abdomen. Oh my God. But, anyways, here's a perfect example. Some would want to approach an ectopic pregnancy as, well, let's just get in there and disconnect the baby. And it's going to die. It's not going to reattach, you know. Well, that is a direct attack. That is the action there is evil, right? That is different from saying the woman is going to die or whatever, and so we're going to snip out part of the fallopian tube. Well, snipping out part of the fallopian tube is not a direct attack on the baby. That's getting rid of the ectopic pregnancy. That's, you know, but that's where doctrine of double effect can come in there too. You know, what's going on? What is your action? Is your action itself evil? And then what's the intention here? Obviously, if your intention is to get rid of the baby, then that makes the whole thing evil, because all three of them need to be upright, the action to be upright.
It seems like sometimes it's very worse than worse, you know. I mean, like, there are people who are very sick.
Mm-hmm. That's a perfect example of doctrine of double effect, because is my intention, this person is in so much pain, they're screaming and flailing and everything else, and they're in so much pain that my intention is simply to keep them out of pain. But I know, because maybe the doctors have told me that, you know, you give enough of this med, it's going to be a lethal dose on the liver, the person's going to die. I got a text message and lost my thought. it's just buzzed. Okay, so you know the person's going to die. You know the person's going to die if you give them this one last dose of morphine. But my intention, see, that's the beautiful thing about the doctrine of double effect, is the doctrine of double effect is talking about something that is foreseen. Like, I know, not even like a maybe might happen, but like, I know that if I do this, you know, like with the uterine cancer, you know, the baby's going to die. There's no way the baby might still live. It's going to die. Or in this case, like, the lady's going to die, one last dose. My intention is not to kill her. My intention is simply to keep her out of pain. And if that is what is necessary, if it is that, you know, last dose that's going to do it, so long as it's not being done to hasten the person's death, so long as I'm not doing this to try to kill the person, to put them out of their misery, so to speak, and to try to kill them, you know, as long as that's not my...
Their argument is going to fall, though.
Right.
You know.
Well, is my intention to keep them out of pain, or is my intention to kill them? Because if my intention were to kill them, there are other ways I could kill them. You know, I could just stab them. I could take a knife and slit their throat. I could
right.
I could inject them with some kind of something else.
Well, just do the mercy killing, overload them with morphine.
Right. Right.
You know.
Right, and then that, obviously, you know, but it has to, in a situation like that, you would say, well, obviously what they're doing is beyond what is necessary. You know, sure, I mean, I'm fine right now, but if someone just pumped me full of morphine, I would die. You know, I wouldn't feel anything, and then I would probably die, right? Because everything would just kind of shut down and, you know, everything. But I don't need that right now for pain. I'm not in pain, you know. So that's why we talk about the proportionate value between the, you know, what's being given, what proportion, what good is it causing, versus, you know, how is it relieving a person of pain that's there, or not. But again, that's why. Everything is like I said, it's patient specific. We're not going to just say it's always bad or it's always good to give someone morphine.
Subjective. I mean, like that whole example you used, like with getting a special medicine or something, and if it's only going to keep you alive two more days versus the day, and the cost effective, that kind of spooks me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a financial burden to me could be totally different than a financial burden to them.
Sure.
Yeah. And so 3 more days of something that, well, we'll just move it along a little quicker today. It just seems,
right.
I don't know, the intention and subjectability is very important.
Well,
personal counsel from every.
And that's why what's often, you know, said and repeated is that, you know, it needs to be on a case-by-case situation. We can't just look and say X always has to be done or X can never be done. You have to, and again, this summarizes that well, I think. Like, for instance, let me just read you the quick little paragraph on pain-relieving medication here. If my condition includes physical pain, I wish to receive pain-relieving medication in dosages sufficient to manage the pain, even if such dosages make me less alert or responsive. And again, this is provided already. I've been able to say goodbye and receive the sacraments, whatever else. And even if managing my pain in this way is likely to shorten my life, no pain medication should be given to me for the purpose of hastening my death. So, because there are certain pain meds that if you give people, it's going to shorten their life by virtue of the attack that it causes on the liver. But at the same time, you know, the foreseen side effect is that your life is going to be shorter. But my intention is not to hasten your death. My intention is to keep you out of pain, which this is going to do. This will keep you out of pain. And without this, you might live 10 days in misery. But with this, you'll live 5 days in no pain. Okay, so my intention is not, maybe my intention is, in which case it would be wrong. And the other thing to think about, to just remember with intention, is the only people who really know intention is the person, him or herself, and God. I mean, I can tell you what my intention is, but I could always be lying. You know, I know what my real intention is deep down inside, and God, and that's it. I can tell people, oh, well, my intention is blah, 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 but who knows, you know. So, yeah.
The tech wasn't the hospital, was it?
Say again?
The tech wasn't the hospital calling you, was it?
No. No. Quick, hurry up. No. Yeah, it's funny because, you know, we'll get these kinds of situations where, like, the hospital doesn't call when they should have, and then we'll get other people who call the rectory when they shouldn't, like at 5 a.m. wanting to know the mass schedule. I think I might just start answering the phone. Rectory, what is your emergency? And then, I'm just looking. Oh, okay, I'm sorry. So why didn't you go to the voicemail? Or why didn't you pick that extension? Oh, okay, you were lazy. Oh, right, okay. Oh, because it's all about you and you need an answer right now. Oh, okay, I'm sorry, yeah. It drives me up the wall sometimes. Because it's like, look, I'm happy. I am happy to be wakened in the middle of the night if someone is dying. I have no problem. I'm not one of those priests who says, only bother me 9 to 5. If someone's dying in the middle of the night, call me and I will be there like that. But if it's something like, I just don't get it sometimes. But that's why I told Father Robert, I said, one of the first things we have to do is we have to fix this recording to say something like, if and only if this is an emergency requiring the immediate sacramental ministration of an ordained priest, press 2. If this is anything else, including you just want to talk, you need to know the mass schedule, you want to leave someone a message, you want to know what the dates of VBS are, you want to, you know, read your bulletin, follow the extensions, leave a message, we'll get back to you, send an email, but don't push 2, because then you're going to get rung to the rectory and you're going to wake someone up and they're going to be ticked if it's nothing important. Again, if someone's dying, happy to go, happy to go. And I've done that. Actually, my record was twice in a single night. I actually had gone to bed early one night, about 10 o'clock, and I got a call about 11:30, and I had actually, like, I was asleep, you know, he had just fallen asleep, but all right, so I put on my casket, go to the hospital, do my thing, come back, went back to bed, and then again, 3:30. And then it's like the next morning I had the monastery mass at 7:15, and I'm like, walking. And I'm happy to do that. That's what I was ordained to do. You know, they have a saying at the seminary that we were ordained to be inconvenienced, which is very true. But I just happen to wonder, like, how much is that being abused? So that's my rant on the phone system. But that being said, if your loved one is dying, please do not wait. Again, do not wait until they have died to call the priest. Because then everything's conditional and we don't know. So, any other questions? Yes. That's an emergency.
It's an
unusual call. No, that's a real emergency. And I've had that. And there have been a few situations where it wasn't so much the person's dying, but like we need to make a medical decision right now. Yeah, sure. No, I'm talking about stupid stuff. I just don't want people calling me at 5 in the morning asking what time Vacation Bible School is. That's happened. Yeah, it happened like last week during Vacation Bible School. So, no.
What you need to do is take and put, have 1, 2, 3, 4. You
want
to create
number 5. Yeah, all the way at the end.
Put it at the end. That way, if they waited through all of them.
One time I got a call to the hospital, and the person wasn't Catholic, and I am happy to go and visit anyone who wants to see a Catholic priest. You could be an atheist, and if you want to see a Catholic priest, I will be there. So I'm not one of those people who says, oh, well, they're not even Catholics, I'm not going to go. No, they don't have to be Catholic. They can be anything, and if they want to see a Catholic priest, I'll be there. This person, however, did not even want to see a Catholic priest. They just said, oh, they just wanted someone to come and talk. So you woke me up in the middle of the night just to go and talk? Like, couldn't the nurse have just talked with her? Like, couldn't anyone else have just talked to her? Anyway, I don't want to sound like I'm complaining. But it was weird stuff like that, you know. I got there, like, Catholic on, oil's ready to go. And they're like, oh, we're not even Catholic. And then they even said something. They said, well, it's all the same, isn't it? And I thought, hell no. I was just so mad. Like, we just wanted someone to talk. The nurse is on duty. She could talk. Anyways. Yeah. I know. All in a year. But I've had a lot of firsts at that hospital, too. There are a lot of times where there was one time where I was really kicking myself in the butt for kind of putting up a bit of a, not a fight, but just a certain resistance, because there was one call and they said the person's having trouble sleeping. and they want to talk to a priest. I said, oh, like, well, maybe I should come in the morning so that they can get to sleep, you know, and actually be well rested. And no, you should come now because, you know, they're probably not going to be able to sleep until you, fine. So I went there and I was just complaining to myself and to God, like the whole drive over there. And then I got over there, and this particular person wanted to go to confession, and it was Blessing Father Fresh, and it's been 50 years since I thought, wow, thank God I'm here. And it was just one of those things where I was kicking myself in the butt the whole way over there, and then I was like, sorry, God, I'm glad I did come. But even still, it's one of those things like, really? You just wanted to talk at like 3 in the morning? So, any other questions?
Right.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, so, yeah, you can, again, you can fill this out today and sign it and have a witness, and it has the force of law in the state of Maryland, but you do need to, and it actually has very good instructions. This whole first page is just instructions on how to fill it out, and it says, don't sign it until you have the witnesses and do this, and then make copies and sign the copies. Don't copy it once it's been signed and tells you who to. So that's a very good point, thank you, Tina, because otherwise it really is no good if it's in a lockbox at the bank. So, but to have both of those too, because again, a person is better than a paper.
We've had issues at the nursing home where someone's been taken to the hospital and nobody had that piece of paper to take with them, and then they make decisions at the hospital that are against that living will.
Right, and when you can't blame them if they don't have the will there, I mean, how do they know? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But again, that's why the person, the healthcare power of attorney too, because there have been people who would say who would take that Maryland state, like if you just go to your lawyer and ask for a living will, they'll charge you $500, and they'll give you the sheet that I could give you for free, which isn't very good because it has just the check boxes. You just check it and sign it. And again, it says something like always give me artificial nutrition, hydration, and then you're in a situation where giving it to you is going to kill you. But you said to always give it to you, so well, fine, we'll keep the IV plugged into you. But you're just going to like swell up. Yeah. So that's why it's good to have that healthcare power check. Anything else? So let me leave these here.